Welcome to the 36th episode of the 6th season of the Ubuntu podcast, coming to you recorded in a car in a hotel car park.
You mean our portable recording booth?
Yes.
Studio C.
Studio Y-Reg. And we have just been going to Og Camp this last weekend, and we've got a very special Og Camp show for you, which is going to be a made-up of interviews conducted by our very own Laura.
Yes.
You've been very busy doing loads of interviews, haven't you?
Yes, I did 6 interviews.
Okay, go on, who have we got?
Stacey Driver, I think it was, from who was selling PCB boards. They produce PCB boards.
Ragworm,
small.
I think.
Ragworm, they? That was it. Anya Maguire from Scraper Wiki. Patrick Fenner, who'd built a Minecraft crane.
That was really cool.
Yeah. James Hugman from Firefox OS.
Yes.
Mobile phone operating system.
Who Alan had a bit of a fight with.
Well, it wasn't so much a fight as a...
a war of words.
Yeah, like a dance battle thing, but without the dance.
Dance-off.
Yeah, kind of. We, yeah.
It didn't get physical.
No, it didn't. It was well attended, and there were lots of good questions. And,
yeah.
Yeah, it was good
points
fun.
Made, yeah.
It was very courteous. Russ DL and Paul Harter, who are a Minecraft artist and 3D printer, respectively. And Kevin Hoyle from Shrimpingit.
From where?
Shrimping
they make like bare bones Arduinos with, they basically get just the chip and some components in a breadboard, and they make sort of the minimum compatible Arduino thing to base other sort of circuitry on.
So it's cheaper.
Yeah.
Oh, fantastic.
There's quite a lot of hardware related stuff, you know, loads of talks at Og Camp, but there was quite a few hardware related things that were quite interesting to go and play with and learn about, and quite a lot of Arduino based stuff.
Yeah, and Raspberry Pis as well.
Yeah, way more Raspberry Pis than any other Og Camp we've ever seen before, yeah.
Yeah. So what were your impressions of Og Camp this time around?
I think it was the best one so far. And I because I wasn't one of the organisers, I managed to, like, in my own time, wander
enjoy
the talks. But one of the things that I thought was brilliant was the impromptu talks that... Yeah, it's an unconference, so we schedule some talks, but... there's a lot of gaps for people to come along and give a talk, and we encourage people to do that, and they did. But then during one talk, someone suggested something else they'd like to learn about, and a couple of people had a discussion, and suddenly there was a talk about that new subject appeared on the schedule, and it was really well attended. So yeah it worked out really, really well.
Yeah. Lorna Jane did an impromptu talk on basics of Git.
Yes.
And she'd been hoping not to do a talk all weekend for once.
To be fair, well, it was originally going to be John Spriggs and me doing the talk, and then she spotted it and offered, and we thought that she would probably be better placed to do it and actually be able to, you know, have an air of knowing what you're talking about than we did.
It was quite funny to see the look on her face as half an hour dwindled as you and John were talking about your various use cases and how you use GitHub, and she was sat there knowing how many slides she had that she could have gone through, and the amount of time left for her to actually talk dwindled and dwindled and got down to about 10 minutes, and she powered through loads of slides, really, really good info, and the slides are available online. I think she's tweeted a URL to them, but it's really, really good, really, you know, good information from all three of you.
I think it was a really great atmosphere this weekend, and because it's an unconference, it does depend so much on the people who actually turn up to help shape it.
Absolutely.
And we had some great scheduled speakers, but the things that were going on in the unscheduled tracks were just fantastic.
Yeah. And also the people just, you know, milling around, looking at the exhibition, playing on the arcade machines, and yeah, it was all just like a really good atmosphere.
I found out how to do an Og Camp.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah, that was
my talk. I'm sort of trying to encourage people who might have only attended Og Camp before, if you think you'd be interested in helping organise a future event, then, you know, we'd very much welcome input from other people if you've got, you know, a bit of time or a lot of time or effort which you think you'd like to sort of contribute to the event, then we'd be very happy to hear from you.
Maybe we could recap some of your talk in a future episode.
That sounds like a good idea.
Yes.
There was a few talks that had no slides. There would just be someone standing there with holding something and showing it off, or opening a couple of websites and saying, these are the websites you get more information, and then just talking. One guy did a talk about quadcopters and tricopters, and I've always looked at quadcopters and thought they looked cool, but some of them are a bit expensive. And he showed us all the really cheap ones you can use to get started, and gave us loads of tips on which ones would be best for beginners, and, you know, the right equipment to buy and stuff. And, you know, it's kind of kindled my my desire to have a little flying device that I can buzz around the kids' bedroom and wake them up in the morning.
Excellent. Well, let's listen to the interviews.
I'm in one of the foyers of Og Camp and looking at the Minecraft crane thing. This is Patrick Fenner who built it, I think.
Yep.
Can you describe it to us?
It's basically a giant wire-supported Delta robot. So in place of the solid links that you normally get, it's then using a cable running over motor spools. So by moving the top pulleys further apart, you then increase the triangular area that it can work over. So I think we're running at about 8 meters in each side of the triangle, which gives us a good size working area, and I think we must be up to about 4.5 meters in working height. There's just a very small working head on it, which I've got attached a big Minecraft block, effectively. I will be doing a release mechanism for it next, but I've just got a permanently attached block to be able to show, so that there's something big on there for people to drive around and play with.
Yes, these blocks are about, I don't know, say a foot by a foot,
yeah,
cube.
About 250 mil square cube.
And they've got these little cardboard discs on the top and then holes cut out in the bottom, sort of a bit Lego-like.
Yeah, similar to a 2x2 Lego block, but really nice and big.
And lots of people decorating them.
Yes, so black white boxes, and then we were just leaving it open to see what people did, and the kids around have scrounged up all sorts of paints and crayons and pens and all sorts and they're decorating a full Minecraft set for us. We've got the four bits of a Steve in there somewhere, and a TNT block at the bottom, which I'm hoping doesn't go off.
So how did you start doing this?
It was to do with print crafting with Paul Harter, and then they wanted to do a print crafting day with FACT in Liverpool. I suggested a giant-sized crane, to be able to do pick and place with the Minecraft blocks, so that you'd get some direct interaction to be able to move the crane around. In this case, actually just moving the motors directly, so not even bothering with the difficult kinematics, letting the drivers sort that out, so that they can then pick up blocks and move them around and then drop them and build structures bigger than they can, like a giant real-life Minecraft building set.
Cool, and the controls, as you were saying before about the pulling the wires, the controls are effectively just three up and down switches.
Yes, I have done, like, the maths is relatively straightforward. It's named trilateration after the mathematical formulas. So each of the wires effectively is the radius of a sphere, and the intersection of those spheres gives you the position of the head. But for when I've done it with the maths left in and doing all the kinematics, it's not actually as good fun to drive as if you just have three sticks to raise or lower each of the, or lengthen or shorten each of the three wires to be able to then play around and move it yourself. So in the way that it's set up at the moment, moving all three sticks up will move the header up, all three down moves it down, and then because of the direction we're facing, if you move two and three opposite to each other, it sweeps across you. And then if you move one opposite to two and three, it moves towards or away from you, ish.
And what, is it a Raspberry Pi or something in there?
It's all Arduino. We've got an Arduino Uno inside, which is taking the analog inputs from the thumbsticks to determine the step direction and rate. And then that's just sending step direction pulses out to some shrimps which are acting as motor controllers to then step the stepper motors.
Okay, and what are you going to do next with it? You said about being able to do releases and things. Is that the next thing?
The next thing is then I had a release mechanism to the head. It's because it's really safe around people, there's almost no inertia in the head, then you can then let people interact with it directly, so they can pass off a block to it, take it up, try and place it, and then, because they're just empty cardboard boxes, it doesn't matter if they fall down and bury somebody.
And what do you see happening then when you can do that?
We'd like to do some educational stuff around it. We'd actually quite like to do an installation somewhere and to do some courses around it. We've got the blocks themselves, so perhaps to be able to do some of the circuit building stuff that's in Minecraft and do it physically. And then to be able to do, because there is such complex kinematics that you have to kind of do accidentally in order to run it, then you're starting to be able to teach people about even the uses of trigonometry at a stage when they think it's boring.
And could you have people building things directly in Minecraft and it just simulates that in reality?
Yeah, no reason why not. I have got half of a G-code interpreter for it, so it could then take... I do quite like the idea, because we're working with Paul Harter, who runs Printcrafting, who does 3D prints from Minecraft building plots. If you could then take the positions of the blocks in the building block, the idea was that if you build blocks using a giant pick and place, it's quicker than doing big 3D printing. So it's 3D building, although I think that's a real thing already.
Okay, and where can people find out more?
Nowhere at the minute. I haven't written it up yet. it will go up on my website. It's def-proc.co.uk. Delta Echo Foxtrot - Papa Romeo Oscar Charlie.
Cool. And do you have a Twitter account or anything like that?
Yeah, is DefProc. Okay. Short for Deferred Procrastination.
Nice. Okay, thanks very much and good luck with it, with your next steps.
Thank you.
Thanks. And I'm here with Kevin Hoyle from the Shrimping It project. Kevin, would you like to explain what Shrimping It is?
Sure, yeah. The Arduino project is a very popular way for people to build devices with behaviour, inventions, if you like. Historically, it's not been that popular in classrooms because it's expensive to source the boards. And it has some problems, which is... given it's so expensive, you don't tend to be able to give those to the kids to take home. So we started out trying to figure out how to educate teachers how to make an Arduino-compatible project in the way that an electronics engineer would do, which is to keep the costs extremely low and construct it by hand using the raw components. And we've been socializing that and sharing more and more detailed information, diagrams, lesson plans, and so on, that enable teachers to teach essentially electronics engineering in the classroom. So what we have now is the Shrimp, which is an Arduino compatible. You can make up an Arduino from a bag of bits. It costs us £2. We're selling them here twice our wholesale costs. If you go online to shrimping.it, you'll find lots of information describing the kits that we offer and also the places that we buy the parts and how much it costs us. So if you want to buy 50, it's well worth your while buying direct from the wholesalers. If you want to just buy one or two to get started, get in touch with us and we can mail them out to you.
And what's your background? Is it in electronics or teaching? Or?
My background is originally in software, and Arduino creates a great opportunity for turning hardware problems into software problems. You can attach a few sensors to a little computer and then spend the rest of your time designing the behavior in software. And I used that in interactive art for many years. And through that experimentation, figured out some of the simpler ways to use microchips, sensors, to create experiences, if you like. And it's that focus that I'm really trying to bring to the work, which is creating performances as much as learning about code. And my belief is that's going to reach out to people in a way that code, learning code for itself, or learning electronics for itself, doesn't necessarily attract people. Whereas when you can see what you can do with it and what you can achieve, And when you see it as a means of empowering yourself and creating crazy things, that's much more like the kind of emphasis we'd like to see. And so that's how we're curating our projects. All of our projects do something. They're not experiments. They don't just flash an LED. They paint words in the air. So that's kind of the emphasis we have.
I was going to say, have you got any examples of the craziest projects that have been using this?
Well, the craziest, there's a lot of people around the world that are doing crazier things than us with it. I was just watching somebody who built a great big block stacking machine in the atrium of this building with three shrimps. There are people that are driving robots with them. The projects that we offer for workshops and working in classrooms involve things like a persistence of vision display, so that paints messages in the air using LEDs. We also have projects like the memory game, which is a clone of the MB game Simon that flashes buttons and you have to remember a whole sequence. And those are things that will give you an entry point to working with prototyping materials, pushing things into a breadboard to make a circuit, and then you'll also see the software, the process of uploading it. You'll even be encouraged to tweak the software a little bit and see the consequences of your changes. That just means you've got that context, you've got that awareness of what's there, and it's a much smaller step for you to then go, well, I want it to do this. I'm going to actually pull all of the LEDs out of that thing. Don't want it to flash anymore. I want it to control this servo, and that's going to be triggered by squirrels. You know, that's the kind of thing we're hoping to see. And we see quite a lot of it online. If you follow our Twitter feed at Shrimping It, there's a lot of people commenting on the projects that they're producing.
Well, Shrimping is compatible with Arduino. Is it open source hardware like Arduino?
Yeah, in many ways, what we're doing is turning the data sheets that come with the Atmel chip into something that is comprehensible by regular people. So it is nothing new. We make no claims about the kind of innovation of the design, but we do focus on making it accessible, making it possible for people to comprehend and to take their early steps, get familiar with the material. So we're really curating what is already known in a community of experimenters, practitioners, engineers, but making it more available for regular people. The shrimp doesn't know it's not an Arduino Uno. It doesn't realise it's a brain in a jar. It thinks it's an Arduino Uno. You treat it exactly like an Arduino Uno, and for most projects it's completely a substitute.
Okay, cool, thank you. So shrimping.it is the website.
Yeah.
And what, can you say your email address again?
Yeah, the Twitter ID would be at shrimpingit. You can send us the contact details are at shrimping.it online. So get in touch with us and let us know how we can help.
Brilliant. Thank you very much. And thanks for coming to OgCamp.
Thank you.
Stacey Driver from the Ragworm Project. Do you want to start by telling us what the Ragworm Project is?
The Ragworm Project is all about making electronics prototyping more accessible within the UK. We are manufacturers of printed circuit board, and we designed the Ragworm website in order to remove all of the red tape to prototyping in the UK. So there's no minimum order values, no minimum quantities, and it's all done online using a very simple calculator. And we've also created a section on the site where people can promote their latest projects. So we also go more in depth about what the circuits are being used for and help people and give them a platform to put their projects onto.
And how did it get started?
It got started really by meeting people within this industry. We had a couple of customers that we were going out and talking to, and they started to introduce me to things like the Raspberry Pi, like the Mini Maker fairs, and from there and walking around I could see that there was very little prototyping being done in the UK. We think that a lot of the projects that are done in these environments are the projects of the future. There's the entrepreneurs of the future here as well, and we wanted to come up with an idea that would support those and bring that manufacturing back into the UK, also giving them full protection of their IP of their projects, which is lost when you send your designs abroad.
Oh, right, okay. Yeah. What's your background in all this? Do you work in this area?
Well, my background actually was that I did a law degree, and I moved into this as a family business after university. Stickleback is the company which Ragwem is a service of. So I'm the business development manager at Stickleback, and I was given a brief to find the missing link in the industry and find a new area that we could support and grow in. And this is what I came across, and Ragwem was developed as a result of that.
So how many of you are involved in this?
Stickleback currently has 9 employees, and we're continuing to grow all the time. We have somebody employed with us dedicated to run Ragwem, respond to all the tweets, respond to the emails. So it's a real-time response all the time. And it also gives it a very personal feel that you can send in any questions that you might have, and there's someone there to answer them.
So what kind of projects do you get?
It really varies. Today we've been asked to look into making chassis for tricopters. We make boards for robotic cars. Some people are sending us modifications on spark fun designs, things like that. And then we're also working with people that are trying to develop kits that will go out into the industry that people can build themselves. We also work in many commercial sectors as well, so we have people from universities sending us prototypes that are for highbrow scientific research. So it really varies right across the board, and we're always interested in trying to find new work. We have a strapline for the company, Stickleback, which is "Where different is normal." So we like to think of ourselves as an agile and responsive manufacturer, and really anything that you foresee as a problem, we hope to, you know, we like to work with people to find an answer to that and keep pushing the boundaries of what the circuit board can do and what you can achieve with it. So we're looking into things like using circuit boards as artistry, so making the circuit board the exterior and exposing the electronics so that more of the community are exposed to what goes on inside the electronic devices they use in everyday life.
Do you go around a lot of different conferences? Because today you've got a stall and yesterday at OGCamp. Do you go around a lot of conferences like this, community events?
Yeah, Ragwem's fairly new, so we've come into the calendar year fairly late on. So this year we've travelled to the Dublin Mini Maker Fair, Brighton, London, going around the country. We're based in Kent, but we'll travel to wherever the event's going on. We attended Wuthering Bytes, and next year we hope to get out to all of the hack spaces, go to all of the events like this, and we're always keen to find out who's running what, how we can support it, how we can be involved, and keep getting out there meeting people.
Cool. And where can people find out more?
We have a dedicated Ragwem website, which is www.ragwem.eu. You can find us on Twitter at Ragwem UK. We have a Flickr page and an Instagram page as well, so we're trying to keep ourselves as visual as possible. Stickleback has a website as well, which is www.sticklebackuk.com.
Sounds great. Okay, good luck with all that, and possibly see you here next year at OGCamp.
Thank you very much.
We've got Russ DL and Paul Harter, who are artists and doing things with Minecraft. Could you explain to us what your projects are, just as an overview, please?
I've got a project that started with my children, doing 3D printing with Minecraft. So my kids were obsessively playing Minecraft, and I had a 3D printer, and I was just trying to get them interested in CAD and making 3D models and failing, and had the idea of pulling models out of Minecraft and printing those. And that's just, that one little idea has snowballed and now become a kind of big, strange, rambling project that's taken up the last year of my life and been a quite fun adventure. And I've met people like Ross and other people up here in Liverpool, and we're putting together a kind of a big Minecraft project at FACT, which is going to be, there's going to be an event, but also ongoing kind of Minecraft activities.
Cool. Ross, what's your angle?
Well, I'm kind of an artist based in Liverpool, and I'm kind of generally interested in technology, culture. I generally put together strange social events where you get to meet people like Paul and people like Patrick Fenner, an open source engineer, and do some sort of playful events as a way for different people to experience what's happening in sort of technology. But I'm particularly interested in Minecraft because, like Paul, my children are obsessive Minecraft players. So I'm sort of interested in Minecraft as a space for exploring education and learning. And I think through the kind of big fact project is that's something they're interested in. I think we're all interested in is this, like, Minecraft is a sort of space that young people are kind of inhabiting, not just using and gaming, but they're kind of involved in the infrastructure, or they're beginning to be involved in the infrastructure of the game itself. And in the terms of like OggCamp, it's a project that's not technically open source. It's not open, but it's almost like the enthusiasm of the community is kind of forcing it open, not in a kind of negative hacking way, but the kind of modding culture. What do you think about that?
Minecraft itself is a proprietary bit of software, but they've encouraged around it an enormous community of people that have extended and modified Minecraft. And involvement in playing the game often extends into understanding the technology, running your own servers, scripting the game. So there's quite a kind of even transition from gameplay into understanding and playing with technology, which is part of kind of the fun of Minecraft as a game.
Yeah, and I suppose we're here at the Open Hardware Jam because all these amazing open hardware projects are kind of about that, of kind of opening up their ways into engaging with technology in sort of ways that are maybe outside of this sort of mainstream narrative of what computers are and how they should be used. So, yeah.
Ross, you mentioned earlier to me a project at Ray Castle that was to do with Minecraft, sort of.
I did, as part of our kind of research together with FACT and everybody, is I did a family workshop in a National Trust property, which is a place called Ray Castle by Windermere, which is itself a kind of folly built in the 19th century. And we were kind of imagining Minecraft as a sort of contemporary folly kind of thing. So we were like designing ruins that were originally fake ruins and redesigning them and replacing them virtually in Minecraft. And I kind of like that idea of Minecraft as a design tool or a prototyping tool.
I think the thing about being parents of kids that play Minecraft is very interesting as technologists, because it's a space where parents and children or different generations can come together on very equal terms over the technology. And so often there's adult technology and there's children's technology. And I think what's very nice about this space is it's one where it's a kind of cross-generational space where people can be playful with technology. So I think the kind of the family space, or at least that cross-generational space, is not very common in technology. So I think I'm enjoying that as the thing. I think it's similar.
I mean, I have noticed that OggCamp this year feels quite family friendly. It's there seems to be more children around than last year, and I think that was because last year you'd kind of notice, oh, they brought their kids, and so I suppose it's breaking down those normal barriers between, oh, that's a children's project and this is art. This is art for children, and this is art for adults, and it's kind of breaking those things down. I think that's what's exciting about this project, however it turns out. So,
what's next for your project?
Next, I've slightly foolishly decided to go to Minecon, which is in Florida, and so in eight days, I'm flying off to Florida with my kids. Because the project's been kind of a joint project with them. I've got two boys. And this is kind of almost exactly a year into when we started doing it. So I'm not sure quite what happens next, really. We're having this kind of big bash. I've got this lovely project at FACT. I'm working with Ross. And I'm not quite sure what to do with it next.
I mean, one thing that just struck me then was just like everybody thinks of the dream holiday for your kids is that you surprise them that you're going to Disney. But actually, if I'd told Jacob, surprised him who's going to Minecon, that would kind of blow his mind more than Disney by about a factor of about 6 or 10. Yeah. I don't know.
I have, yeah, several kind of mad world conquering plans of creating network-based ways of children sharing models and passing them around, separating them out of the game, taking them into the real world and back into the game, which are quite abstract at the moment still, but we're making plans, and we're going to be working with John Moores University on some of that, so we're not sure exactly what yet, but something quite cool.
Yeah. Oh, I was just going to mention, the connection to John Moores, one of the researchers, Dr. Mark Wright, who's working between FACT and John Moores, he's kind of interested in objects that know themselves or know what they're doing. And so there's some kind of, that's kind of happening in Minecraft. They're objects that have got, children invest a lot of emotional investment into these kind of virtual spaces and objects. And so bringing it in and out of the virtual world and exploring that is something it's going to happen, I think.
Giving children ways of handles on their objects and ownership of them, and ways to share them with other kids.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And if people want to find out more about the sorts of things you're doing, do you have a website or anything?
Yep. Printcraft.org.
Okay. Thank you very much for talking to us. I'll leave you to go carry on tidying up now. Thanks for coming to our camp.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Pleasure.
With Anya Maguire from Scraper Wiki. Would you like to start by explaining what Scraper Wiki is?
Hello. Scraper Wiki is a place on the web where coders can write scripts to liberate data. So if they've got information that's unstructured on the web, it might be in HTML or it might be in a PDF or CSV or Excel, and they want to convert that into a structured format for reuse, then Scraper Wiki is the place to come.
So how does it work?
Coders can sign up for an account in Scraper Wiki. They can either use what we call a code in the browser tool, where we've got an IDE where you can type in your code and they can write scripts that way. And we've got libraries that are built to easily go off and get the data. Or they can SSH in, and we've got it integrated with GitHub, and they can easily then write in their own preferred language in order to collect the data.
So how long is it? A Scraper Wiki been going, and how did it start?
We opened in 2010. We managed to get some funding from Channel 4, the media company, and we started off, and we still are very much involved with the media sector, because journalists have a need to focus more on mining data in order to do data-driven journalism. So Channel 4 was a good partner for us. So we ran some what we called Hacks and Hackers Hack Days across the UK and Ireland, 12 to be exact. And we were successful at bringing software developers and coders together to create stories in the media sector. And then we managed to get some funding. We caught the attention of the Knight Foundation America, which is a big foundation for funding innovation in the media sector, and they gave us a few hundred thousand dollars to make a footprint in the US.
And have you got any examples of specific things that like stories or projects that have come out of using Scraper Wiki data?
A recent project that we're working on, which is very exciting for us because it's focused on humanitarian data. It's for the United Nations Organization for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs. UN OCHA, as it's known, coordinates all of the agencies on the ground in the event of a catastrophe somewhere in the world. At the moment, the way that works is the agencies are eyeballing lots of different data sets. They have to navigate through the World Bank, or they might navigate through the World Health Organization website. And whilst all the data's there, it's buried and difficult to find. So we've been working on a project to collate approximately 130 or 160, forgive me, data sets about every country in the world, and we're gathering the data from all of these different sources, including the UN itself. We've cleaned, we've normalized the data. So now the UN OCHA, we've also conducted some analysis on the data, and we're able to give them some visualizations showing attributes and indicators about countries that it wasn't possible to see them before. So it's a fantastic project, and it's also really interesting because it's humanitarian data.
Yeah. So how did you personally get involved? Where did you come from before this?
I have been in the industry for a long time. I worked in the Microsoft world. I worked for Microsoft Business Partnership. I set up a Microsoft Partner Business many years ago in the 90s. And I got involved in ScraperWiki because it's a kind of family. I'm one of the founders. My brother decided that he wanted to invest in ScraperWiki with a very good friend of his and a wonderful technical person, probably one of the best technical brains in the UK PLC, Dr. Julian Todd, who's based here in Liverpool. And Aidan and Julian got together. Julian was always coming up with amazing ideas. So Aidan and Julian decided, let's do something with this idea. And that's how ScraperWiki was born. And then we added lots of other fantastic people to the community, into our business, where people like Francis Irving and Richard Pope was also involved in ScraperWiki at the beginning. And we've got a wonderful team here based in Liverpool.
Cool. And what do you think you'll do next? What would you like to do next with ScraperWiki?
We're a startup. It's so hard being a startup because you have to be able to sustain yourself if you want to grow a team. And if we really want to be a serious player as a startup, we model ourselves on being a Silicon Valley style startup, but that's the intention. But you have to show success. At the moment, what we're trying to do is we're trying to iterate through products to see which products will resonate in the market. Can we find corporate customers who will buy into ScraperWiki as a method to liberate data and to use internal data with lots of public data? In the main, ScraperWiki deals with government published data. Many people in the industry use public data, but they don't really talk about it so much. It's happening everywhere, but people don't talk about it. What we're trying to do from the customer perspective is to build bite-sized tools, maybe less focused on coders, for people who've got non-technical skills, to go out there and get data and do something with it. So, for example, our latest product that we're working on is called a table extract tool that would allow people to point at PDFs somewhere on the net and to grab the tables from the PDF and turn it into data. Now, that's a complex problem, but we'd like to make it easy enough for people who've got non-coding skills. So that's what we're focused on right now, is to get some product success.
Oh, cool. Where would people find out more?
Well, they could go to ScraperWiki.com. That's a good place to start. We also have a very interesting blog. We're employing data scientists, and a number of our data scientists are always writing good blog posts about how to analyze data and visualize it, and some, especially projects like the UN, how we've managed to do that project. So hopefully they'd read our blog and learn more about us by reading our blog.
Brilliant. Thank you very much. It was good to talk to you.
Thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to talk about ScraperWiki.
Thank you. We've just had the raffle cast and everybody's tidying up, so I thought I'd come and talk to James Hugman, or Firefox James, as I keep calling him, about Firefox OS. Hello.
Hello.
Could you tell us briefly what Firefox OS is?
Yeah, sure. It's a project that started off a couple of years ago called Boot to Gecko, and it's a project to bring the web to phones. So when I say bring the web to phones, I mean build a phone entirely out of web technologies.
Okay, and how is that different from something like, I say, Android?
Gosh, that's a hard question. How's it different? Well, Android has a Linux base and the drivers associated with driving the hardware and sensors, and then on top of that is a Dalvik virtual machine, which executes Java source code, and then there's a lot of runtime libraries associated with that. Firefox OS is the same Linux kernel and the same drivers, but it comes up to a certain run level and gets a frame buffer and then passes it straight to Gecko, which is the rendering engine for in Firefox and Mozilla's related products. So once and then Gecko just passes it to a user interface layer called Gaia, which is a JavaScript, HTML and CSS phone user interface.
Cool, and it's specifically for phones?
At the moment, yes. I know that in plan is a tablet form factor. I'm not sure further down the line, other than phones and tablets, but and I'm not sure how much I can say about that.
Okay, and what sorts of things has it got already? I mean, how finished is it, the project at the moment?
Well, for a project the size and complexity of a phone operating system, it's very difficult to define an end state. It's been released in several countries in Latin America and Eastern Europe, but development is still ongoing.
So you can buy it on phones already in some places?
Yeah, some parts of the world it's possible to buy it. The strategy is to take it to market in places that haven't got very large amounts of smartphones or even internet connections. And that's really an intentional strategy for two reasons, for commercial and marketplace reasons, but more importantly, that's where we can have most impact doing social good. Connecting people to the internet has been shown to be very important and for people's living standards and wage earning potential and happiness, actually.
You're not going out competing with, say, Android and iPhone or REST and trying to convert people. It's more going to people who don't already have those sorts of phones anyway.
That's right. And going head-to-head against Android and iPhone and Ubuntu, for example, would, I think, be difficult to do. The market, certainly for those former two, Android and iPhone, are massively mature compared to these new incomers into the market. So it would be foolish, I think, to try and compete head-on. So possibly I'm not sure whether I can comment with plans to release into the US and Europe, but I think that would be wise to consider in the future.
And a big part of that is the sort of the ecosystems and app markets that are available, I guess.
Yeah, and at Mozilla we like to say that the web is the platform, and so an ecosystem is very important for a new phone operating system, and that would include the marketplace, the developers who are able to develop, the developers who are actually developing, the tools, tooling around developing for the phone, and Mozilla has a massive head start in as much as if you want to develop apps for it, then all you need to be is a web developer. And more importantly, if you are already developing mobile websites, then it's not a huge leap in technology to make them mobile web apps.
Is it essentially just a JavaScript application that you package for a Firefox OS phone?
So getting into the sort of the detail, there are multiple types of apps you can have. Essentially, the simplest one would be a hosted app where you're hosting everything yourself and you're using technology such as AppCache to store the data, and the install happens from your website, and it gets more complicated, but more like the walled gardens of Android and iPhone, where you have a zip file which is downloaded with all the resources that you might need for an application. And there are permissions systems and signatures and cryptography to protect those sorts of privileged APIs. Something else to say is the installation APIs are actually all built into the phone itself, and so you can construct your own app store, and so you might have rival app stores all over the web, or you might have magazines doing best ofs, which are which essentially their favourite apps, or a corporate system which might have the blessed apps, or all running their own app stores.
A bit more like the internet.
Yeah, a bit more like the internet, yeah.
Okay, so what do you get already on the Firefox OS as out the box?
Out the box, you get a number of standard apps, such as the phone dialer, written in JavaScript, the email client, SMS, the standard things that you might expect. There's also a marketplace, which is Firefox's marketplace. What else? The bog standard ones like, you know, calculator and settings, and but it's really the marketplace and the web browser which would be the way to sort of expand the functionality of your phone. I know that there are some interesting plans about having, and based around the weirdness or the observation of weirdness of having a Firefox browser in your Firefox OS phone. So there's some really interesting user experience work being done at the moment for future releases.
What else is likely to be coming in the future?
So there's quite a lot of really interesting work being done by some of my colleagues around the APIs that are available, so manipulating the contacts database all the way up to WebRTC, which is a fascinating technology which allows you to do peer-to-peer connections between phones and between between browsers. And peer-to-peer meaning voice, audio and video, and also data connections encrypted. You as a developer don't have to do anything, and so we've already seen this going from Chrome to Firefox and back again, and Firefox to this is desktop, Firefox to Firefox on Android, and also Firefox OS. So there's some really interesting APIs coming soon. Well, I think that's one's already landed. In the coming soon category, I think an interesting thing to talk about would be, say, WebGL on the phone. The WebGL stuff that I've seen is just amazing. For example, compiling with a technology we do called Emscriptum, which takes the Unreal Engine and compiles that down to JavaScript and WebGL. It's just phenomenal.
And that's what you demonstrated earlier today.
That's right, yeah.
Can you see that demonstration anywhere online?
Yes. I believe you need a compatible browser. The one that I was demonstrating was a nightly build of Firefox desktop, but I believe, I'm not sure where it is in the release. But that's it. unrealengine.com/html5.
And in general, if you want to know more about the Firefox OS or get involved even, where would you go?
I would start off at mozilla.com.
It's nice and simple. Thank you very much for talking to us.
No problem. Pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks.
That's all for this episode. Thank you for listening. Join us for our next live show. Ooh, raining quite hard.
Inside Studio C.
Yeah, Inside Studio C on the 6th of November.
Yes, at 20:30 British time, which will be GMT by that point, because the clocks will have gone back.
Yes.
So it'll be 20:30 UTC as well?
Yes. If in doubt, UTC. There's a countdown on the website which tells you how long it is for the next episode.
Look, it's 8:30. It's always 8:30. It's always been 8:30. Yeah. Just arrive at 8:30.
Yes, as long as you live in Britain.
Yes.
Which all the bright people do.
Yes.
Okay.
Okay, good.
Well, we hope you enjoyed that Ogcamp coverage, and I'm sure normal service will be resumed from the next episode with a bunch more random waffle from four people who won't be sat in a car in the rain. Thanks for listening.
Bye. Bye.